You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us this morning John Judge, who is a researcher and lecturer. He's with the Washington Peace Center and the Coalition on Political Assassinations, and in town for a speaking tour. John, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's start out, and we actually had a piece that went from on alternative radio, went from 6 to 7 o'clock. It was on Malcolm X, and I know that you've been working on issues about getting documents out with dealing with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if you can start out and give us an update on how that's been going.
Well, the Coalition on Political Assassinations really started in the mid-90s, and one of the member groups was another group that I founded prior to that called Committee for an Open Archives. And we began to push in the late 80s, early 90s for a bill to release the files on the John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations. We did get a law passed in 92 that led to a release of 6 million pages to date and more to come on the John F. Kennedy assassination, but we were unable to get Martin Luther King's assassination included. We know that there's 600,000 to 700,000 pages still locked up by a congressional order in 1976 by the House Select Committee on assassinations that locks the files up on King till 2036. And part of those files that are pertinent, we believe, are files on the COINTELPRO program, counterintelligence program of the FBI. There were similar defense intelligence programs called Garden Plot and Cable Splicer and Lantern Spike that had to do with rounding up of dissidents and especially African Americans. There were secret plans for internment camps for black Americans in the United States. One of the people that developed those at the Army War College was Louis Gifreda, who later became director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, where they held exercises every year on martial law scenarios and planning and internment. And that continued after Gifreda's reign. He was brought in by Ronald Reagan. and in addition to that, the COINTELPRO was matched by the CIA by something called Operation Chaos. And these were not just to spy on dissidents and political activists, but also to disrupt and destroy their organizations and to pit elements against each other. So the FBI, if they could find a division already going on in an organization, would drive the wedge and manipulate the situation and encourage the division up to the point of it even becoming fatal in terms of the Black Panthers sometimes. And I believe Malcolm X was in fact a situation where there was a split between Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam. And they manipulated that into a situation where the FBI got certain Muslims in a mosque in New Jersey, and they were moved along in large part by Louis Farrakhan to go and kill Malcolm at this theater. But two of the people who were arrested for Malcolm's murder were not the actual gunmen in the situation. And the person who's done the best work on this is a researcher, Babazak Kondo, in the D.C. area. He's got a book out called Conspiracies Unraveling the Assassination of Malcolm X. It's got the most recent stuff, and he tracked down the two real murderers of Malcolm X and found that they had connections also with FBI and COINTELPRO. So in addition to getting government files loose on King, we wanted to get the history of the COINTELPRO records. King's case reopened, as did the JFK case, after the filming of JFK by Oliver Stone. It broke the country up to questions about JFK and gave the momentum for getting those records loose. It's the largest release of classified documents in history, and the law that released those records is a better law by far than the Freedom of Information Act. So other groups have been trying to model release of records for their issues on that law, and we wanted to make a new law regarding Dr. Martin Luther King that would track that law and create an independent review board for the files and go after the history of COINTELPRO and military intelligence and other attacks on black leadership. And one of the people we got involved in that and very interested in it was Cynthia McKinney, a congresswoman from Georgia, very, very courageous woman in the Congress. And she has been had been speaking out about it and wanted to get the files open and wanted to use an opportunity she had to hold a panel as a member of the Congressional Black Caucus at their annual legislative session last September on the King matter. And we had lined up a variety of people that were been involved in the case, including Dr. William Pepper, who was the attorney for James Earl Ray before Ray died in the case that Ray finally got to an actual trial on the evidentiary matters. And he was lucky enough in Memphis to get Judge Joe Brown, an African-American judge, Yale-educated, and an honest jurist who had ballistic experience. And Brown began to test the actual weapon that they identified as the murder weapon and found from the early tests that this was not the gun that had killed Dr. Martin Luther King. This was a gun that Ray had bought and had been used to link Ray to the assassination, but when he did the ballistic test, the bullets fired out of the gun didn't match the slug that was taken from King's body. And so he first tried to compare it to earlier ballistic tests done at the time of Ray's arrest and mini-trial in the 60s, and also tests subsequently done by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. At that point, the Tennessee Supreme Court stepped in and said that he was overreaching, and that was beyond the purview of the case. When he persisted and tried to get a second test done on his own that would prove that the rifle was in fact not the murder weapon, the state Supreme Court stepped in and removed him from the case, saying that he was biased on behalf of James Earl Ray. That they never appointed another judge. Ray died of a liver disease in prison. The rifle went into the custody of the Shelby County Courts, and only recently has been transferred to the custody of the National Civil Rights Museum. But the directors of the National Civil Rights Museum are not interested in allowing the necessary ballistic test on the rifle, at least so far, and Judge Brown has been frustrated in that. But the King family began to press for an opening in the case after Ray's death in order to exonerate Ray and also show what happened. And so Dr. Pepper and they brought a civil trial. They also asked for a full national investigation, open investigation into the case. That was shunted, unfortunately, back by Janet Reno and Clinton back into the FBI, who had already had a long history of covering up in the case, and they merely took two aspects of the case that they said were the only new evidence and tried to discredit the two people that were involved in bringing forward some new evidence in the case, but it was hardly all that's new about it. And so a report came out from them eventually saying, you know, there's nothing new and, you know, the official version holds. But the jury that actually heard the real new evidence in Memphis ruled that not only had Ray not done the shooting, but also that top levels of military intelligence and government intelligence in this country were involved in the assassination in a conspiracy. But it was a civil suit, and it was preordained that Lloyd Jowers, who was the defendant, would pay a $100 fine when they won the case. That had been pre-decided, and because their point was not to go after him. He was a fairly low-level mechanic, you know, picking up the gun and that sort of thing. But they wanted to get the evidence out. And then that $100 paid to the King family was turned over to the Garbage Handlers Union in Memphis, which was the union that King had originally gone to Memphis in 68 to support when he was murdered. So, but the case and these files still remain to be open, and unfortunately, we had that whole panel set up and we're ready to go with drafting a new law and at the end of September, and then September the 11th happened, and all bets were canceled, and the topics of the Congressional Black Caucus meeting, you know, were canceled, and so we were unable to hold. But we're trying to push back now because there are open calls by Attorney General Ashcroft to renew the COINTELPRO. And to restore the FBI's ability to spy on people that are not involved in criminal activity, that are just religious or civil groups involved in dissent. There was a statement just this week in the Seattle Times that the Earth Liberation Front, which is an environmental activist group, is, the, according to James Jarboe, an FBI expert on counterterrorism, is that the Earth Liberation Front is the largest and most active terrorist group in the United States. This kind of targeting is exactly what you know, what we've been talking about since September the 11th, as the danger of going down this route of You know, seeing the world as us and them, and you know, you're with us or against us, you're with us or you're with the terrorists, and then the terrorists can just be identified willy-nilly, you know, as a dissent group or a pocket of resistance to any kind of policy. So it's opening up those gates again, and interestingly enough, when it came out that Ashcroft was calling for this, some of the senior officials at the FBI who dated back into the COINTELPRO period quit the FBI over this call to renew these excesses that they felt, you know, had been curbed in the 1970s, and thankfully so. But, you know, we're told now that we have to have, you know, an FBI out of control that can spy on your computer, spy on your telephone conversations, come into your house without a warrant, without you even knowing they're there, black bag jobs, those used to be called, or sneak and peek, it's called now, you know, and go after you on a whole other level. You know, than they were able to do with or without any evidence of criminal activity, but just because they suspect you. And they obviously have the right to detain people without, you know, without writs of habeas corpus or appearances before judges or juries. And all of these are emergency powers that, you know, have come into being since September the 11th, but that go against basic civil rights. And so I'm hoping that we can renew the process to actually get a law to release these files. But secrecy is one of the big code words for the Bush administration push since September the 11th, and to maintain secrecy and expand it. And so there's actually been a public statement by Ashcroft that if any government agency doesn't want to release files that are being pursued under the Freedom of Information Act, that they will bring the whole weight of the Justice Department behind the government agency in court to stop the FOIA from working.
It was quite a battle to just be able to get the FOIA into reality.
There. Absolutely, and to give you an example of how bad that was, and how, you know, actually the FOIA's uselessness in terms of getting actual government files loose. I mean, it was useful as an anti-corporate investigative tool, but as an anti-government investigative tool, it always suffered because it leaves everything in the hands of the agencies to decide what they will release, and it has a huge open door. Just if it's national security related, you can block it from being released, and you can block it without any time limit on it. You know, just you're just withheld until they want to release it in some other century. So it's a very bad law, and actually how poorly it functioned was how we got support in Congress for the JFK Records Act. From 1964 till 1994, under the Freedom of Information Act, researchers got loose a few thousand pages on JFK. And once the review board was created in 1994 till 1998, 6 million pages were released. So that's the difference between the FOIA and a real release law.
Now, you're in town speaking to students and the public, and of course the big event is today at Kane Hall at 2:30, from 2:30 to 6:30. But one of the primary things you're in town to talk about is September 11th, its aftermath and its implications for those of us here in the States and worldwide. And one of the things, having been to several of your talks this week, that you brought out that no one else has seemed to hit upon so far in our contradictory war on terrorism, is the leader of Afghanistan. He has some interesting ties.
Mr. Karzai, who's been put in as the leader of this interim government, I think is really reflective of the real reasons that we're going into Afghanistan. And one of the things that my research uncovered was that as far back as last July, Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, was visiting India, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and the surrounding countries, telling their leaders that the United States would militarily intervene against the Taliban in mid-October. That was in July, so September the 11th is pretext, but it's not cause for this war. This war has been on the books for some time, and I know, having grown up in D.C. with a Pentagon family, and my mother's job was to project draft calls for the Joint Chiefs, that they plan wars out well in advance, you know, as much as 10 years in advance. And I knew right after September the 11th, when the Pentagon started saying it's a 10-year war, that they had already had a war in mind, and that, you know, that we should take them seriously. Now, Cheney at one point said it's a war that won't end in our lifetime. But what are we really doing in Afghanistan? That has little to do with Al-Qaeda and these terror groups, most of which were created, funded, financed, and trained through the Central Intelligence Agency, sometimes using Pakistani intelligence as the conduit, in order to fight a war to decimate the Soviet Union and weaken the Soviet Union. And that war was an idea of Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's advisor, and actually even before Reagan came in and supported these people that used to be called freedom fighters and are now called terrorists. But as long as they were terrorists against someone else, we thought it was a pretty neat idea to give them Stinger missiles and fund them. And so, you know, we but they, I think, are not the heart of the issue. And in fact, after we were told that we had to go get this evil character, Bin Laden, in his cave, and then told that we had to smoke him out and keep bombing for a month, and you know, then we were told that that wasn't really our mission anyway, and it didn't really matter whether we caught Bin Laden or not, or brought him to justice. You know, it was a whole network. We had to go into as many as 60 countries, and we would eventually get Bin Laden, but not to worry about it. You know, and now we've got 4 more countries on the list, and 2 more that aren't on the list: the Philippines and Colombia, that we're obviously already involved in militarily. And now the beginnings of attacks on groups back home. So it's an expanding situation. But what was going on in Afghanistan in the late 1990s has to do with projections about oil and oil resources. And by 2050, it was projected that the remaining largest oil resource in the world, 80% of the world's remaining oil, would be located in the Caspian Sea region to the north of Afghanistan, in the countries that used to be called the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union. And these are countries that the United States, even after the fall of the Soviet Union, some of these countries continued to have socialist-leaning governments, and those governments were undermined, and that's a large part of the U.S. involvement in Kosovo or Yugoslavia, and those areas had to do with undermining, you know, the remaining pockets of socialist resistance. As well as making sure that they had a, you know, a way to get into Russia and get at the resources in Russia, because Russia has tremendous resources up in that region, and it also has educated and very cheap labor. And so it's a gold mine for these international globalist corporations that want to get their hands on the resources of the world. And so we were intervening there right up to the time. I mean, there were some reports in early September that a terrorist war financed and supported by the CIA was going on in Belarus, or what used to be called White Russia, and that it was on the same scale as the terrorist war that the U.S. conducted in Nicaragua with the Contras, and that they had paid off 300 NGOs, or non-government organizations, in order to create a new government in Belarus once they were done with the terror aspect. This pattern, I mean, is something that the U.S. has been involved with covertly and to a greater extent more overtly since the 1950s and, you know, the end of World War II and coming into the modern era. We've intervened in hundreds of countries and maintain a constant presence. One of the big arguments that broke out prior to this war between the Pentagon and the White House was had to do with whether or not the United States should admit that it's an empire and go about being one, a sort of Pax Americana view of the world. And interestingly enough, I mean, when Bush and his circle brought this up, came out of a guy in a right-wing think tank, that they wanted to do that, the Pentagon people that were in the Joint Chiefs then, heads have rolled since, but the heads of the Joint Chiefs at that point balked and said, no, you know, we've got enough to do without trying to, you know, to live out this empire fantasy. But August 21st in the Washington Post, this the military writer revealed this whole debate that was going on about whether America should openly be an empire. And more recently, the U.S. military has been complaining about the burden it puts on them to maintain a homeland defense here in the United States with all these flights and everything, when they're already committed in over 100 countries abroad. So it is a huge presence all over the world that the U.S. military maintains, and we've intervened in many, many countries and what their politics are in order to maintain investments there. So oil really has, they said by 2050, 80% of the oil is going to reside there, and we're an oil-dependent economy. we're an oil monopolized economy. We don't have to be as dependent on it as we are, but that won't make the profits for the people that control it. We also want to make sure that oil doesn't get cheaply to our competitors in the world markets, Japan and Germany specifically. And we're 4% of the world population consuming 65% of its oil. Of that large bulk of oil consumption, it was projected that by now, the early beginnings of the 21st century, 85% of that oil would be military use. And so our intervention had to do initially with a pipeline that they made a deal, a corporation called Unocal, and it was working closely with it's a big oil company, and then there's a corporation called Halliburton that provides drilling bits for and other oil supply equipment. Is one of the largest ones in the world. And the two of them were working on this pipeline to go from the Caspian Sea south through Afghanistan. They cut a deal with the Northern Alliance. They cut a deal with the Taliban. And then they were going to bring it down through Pakistan to the Persian Sea and out, you know, into the oceans. So all that was being planned in 98, 99. And at some point, the Taliban balked and wouldn't take it. But Unocal was the company that originally developed it. And this Mr. Karzai, who's been put into power now in Afghanistan, was a longtime employee of Unocal. So he's part of that pipeline plan. When they supposedly abandoned the original plan, then there was a plan to go west with a separate pipeline through the cut through the northern part of Afghanistan, but avoid the Taliban issue and go across, you know, to the sea by an alternate route. The company involved in making that plan has been in the news. It's called Enron. Now it looks like we're going to go back to the Unocal plan, and so that's part of who's been brought in. The other thing that comes out of Afghanistan is opium. 80% of the world opium was coming out of there. The Taliban had taken a $43 million government grant from the United States to stop growing it, had curbed some of the opium production in the south, but the Northern Alliance made up for it in the north. And now the people that are being brought in as so-called moderates in the new government from the various Afghani factions are actually people who were named 5 or 6 years ago in the London Sunday Times as the largest opium dealers in the country. So wars have to do with profit. They have to do with expanding markets. They have to do with existing resources. They usually have very little to do with noble causes, good against evil, restoring democracy or anything like that. And it's particularly hypocritical and ironic to me that the Bush administration is jumping up and down about freeing women in Afghanistan, when in fact women had full rights. They had educational access. They were representatives in the government, in the secular government that predated the rule of the mullahs, and it was U.S. funding that created a coup in Afghanistan and put these reactionary mullahs in power. And these fundamentalist Islamic elements who were anti-Soviet and were also anti-women. And then the United States funded and financed the war against the Soviet reaction to that when the Soviets came down and tried to restore the secular government. That was what began this huge war in Afghanistan. And they financed these terrorists, but they also put them in power and kept these reactionary mullahs in power. So that's what oppressed the women in Afghanistan for all these last decades, was U.S.-backed and U.S.-financed anti-Soviet but also anti-democratic regimes. And the U.S. also, you know, funded the Taliban into power. And so now when they take them out for other economic reasons, for us to be claiming that we're liberating Afghanistan, I mean, is pretty two-faced. And in fact, this is not a fully democratic government that's going in there by any means. And the Northern Alliance has its own history of repression against women and brutality in its dealings with people in war and in civil situations. So it's not like we're bringing in the saints, you know, as against the devils.
All right, so you deal, obviously, you've been doing this for 26 odd years, and deal with a lot of what I would call very dark history of the U.S. and worldwide. And one would have to imagine that you would get feel fairly disempowered reading a lot of this. But you actually have alternatives for bringing democracy back to the U.S. here.
Well, I think part of what encourages me, and a lot of people say that to me, you know, how can you know this stuff and not just despair? I can know it, and I think that's part of what gives me hope, is that I am able to get to the bottom of it. If I, couldn't if I just had to flounder around in complete darkness. I mean, you know, then I think I would despair. But I have been able to unearth the history, even though they've been hiding it on the other side. You know, it is possible to know what's happening, just as it was possible in the late 1930s to know what was happening in Nazi Germany. You know, and it was possible to do something about it, but it was, you know, it was difficult, as it will be here. I mean, but this is the time when we have to practice democracy. I mean, to practice it between wars is like being a vegetarian between meals. And this, we're in the position of the German people in September of 1939. Poland has been invaded. World War II and the Holocaust are looming, and the Constitution's being eroded. The rights are being taken away, like it was done after the Reichstag fire in Nazi Germany. And we can decide to be good Germans and salute and go along, or, you know, we can say, no, this is a democracy, and we're not going to play that nasty game, because we have the alternatives. We're in a period of history where technologically we have a surplus, and we have the capability, without as much labor as we expend on a lot of other nonsense, to go ahead and feed and clothe and house everyone and to make everyone part of the human community and to have basic transportation, communication, you know, gadgets, decent housing, clothing, food. All of that is not a challenge at this point, and we can unleash the potentials of the human brain and human consciousness in this period. So one of the things that I've been working on a little bit, I work with a group out of New York called Avenging Angels, and we're basically a communication resource for progressive groups. But we tried to put together an idea after September the 11th of new tasks for Old Glory, as we put it. In other words, something else the flag could do besides fly in the front of a battleship. And the picture on an advertisement that we created, a two-page spread in The Nation, is a woman. She's from Somali, but the point is that, you know, representative of people all over the country that are, you know, near starvation. Yesterday, somebody was pointing out that 2,000 people may have died on September the 11th here in the United States from the bombing, but 35,000 children died of starvation that day and die every day of starvation all around the world. And those are totally, you know, needless deaths. So this woman is cradling a baby in her, you know, next to her shoulder, and the baby is wrapped, a swaddling cloth around the baby is the American flag. And it's a 10-point program that tries to take into account the agendas of many progressive groups that are trying to build an alternative. Of course, the first alternative to this is to use a rule of law instead of a rule of war, to treat this as a crime against humanity and not use it to destabilize the whole world with a constant warfare situation. That's completely dead end. But the 10 points that we outline in what's called a new contract with the planet are to attack world hunger and poverty, to champion the rights of every child and woman and man, to stop our obstructionism to world's treaties and work with the international community and use international law and rule of law to reduce the dependence on oil, to lead the world into an age of renewable energy, to close the book forever on the Cold War and to shut down the nuclear nightmare that we have, to renounce Star Wars and the militarization of space, as well as our own countries, to make globalization work for, not against, people, especially working people, to get money out of politics, and I would probably add get politics out of politics and make real democracy, and to close the gap between rich and poor at home. So there's an attempt to lay out a progressive agenda, an alternative agenda that we have the capability to do and really the necessity to do at this time, because we're forced now into a choice, I believe. We're at a crossroads in modern human history to either go down this nightmare path of recession and war and genocide, or to choose instead a new world, to build a new world that includes everybody and gets rid of violence.
All right. Well, with that, unfortunately, we're out of time. Talking this morning with John Judge, who is a researcher and lecturer. He's with the Washington Peace Center and the Coalition on Political Assassinations. And, John, you're going to be speaking this afternoon at Kane Hall.
It's room 120, I think, in Kane Hall at the University of Washington near, I think it's called Red Square there.
Right, just north of, on the north side of Red Square. And it'll be going from 2:30 to 6:30 this evening. So if you have questions for John or want to hear an expanded version on his views, that would be a good event to come to. So thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much.